Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
Another week, another show. Welcome back, and so good to be here. Well, I say that like I'm with you right now, and I guess I'm not. Sit in the studio by myself, other than my favorite millennial, Darren, the real talent of this operation. Anyway, gotta say it every week. Keep saying it. Got a great show planned this week. Probably for me, the most excited I've been to do a show and to have it air. We got an interview coming up today, and honestly, it's an interview that I never thought I'd do. I never thought I'd have access to it. And I think that it will certainly reinforce and make it the most scintillating hour of finance radio, certainly this week. But we are going to be joined by the one and only Dr. Roger Ibbotson, who's been a bit of an idol of mine. Not idol, that's probably too strong a word, but just a big influencer, a behemoth in the world of finance for the last 50 years. And Dr. Ibbotson's reputation speaks for itself. The guy's got more published work than anybody, been a professor of finance at Yale for 35 years, runs a billion-dollar hedge fund, Zebra Capital Management, worked with Milton Friedman at the school, at Chicago School of Business. His compatriots were the guys that built the Black-Scholes model. He was on a working committee with four Nobel Prize winners. He could have easily won a Nobel Prize as well. He may still. I've long followed his work on valuation, on markets in general, sentiment, all these things. Just a fascinating, fascinating individual. And you know what? It's again, he's not as well known. He's not as wealthy. But, you know, he's right up there in the world of finance in terms of the influence he's had with the Warren Buffetts of the world, certainly the Robert Shillers of the world. And what a wealth of knowledge. And if you have doubted, you know, our dirtiest word in investing, our bond replacement strategy. And look, I've said since the first time we came on the air, the most controversial thing we do and the thing that I know turns the most people off. I literally have had people tell me that. Zach, I listen to your show. I subscribe to your podcast. But I don't like annuities. You know, regardless of whether it's the fixed index or time. And my guys have told me the annuities are bad. Dave Ramsey has told me that annuities are bad. And like we've said from the very beginning, bad compared to what? It's all about context. It also matters which annuities you're talking about. How do they work, right? And if you've ever looked at our website before, you've seen the 17-page academic research paper that Roger Ibbotson put out in 2016 that talked about how these fixed indexed annuities that we advocate as a bond substitute or a bond supplement are going to be phenomenal, and how he expects them to outperform bonds handily. and do it with less fees, right? Because they're fee-free. And get you more upside because you're participating in upside market growth, but with a much bigger layer of security. You're guaranteed against loss. So if you've doubted that, I understand that because I was in your shoes, right? When I first started my career, pretty, you know, literally from, well, not just my career, my life, and I'd laugh at insurance products, and there's a reason for it. Because A, they weren't as good. I don't like traditional annuities because a traditional annuity, and we're going to get to the market update. I just want to set this interview up properly just because it's really not a sales technique. I'm trying to educate people and get people to open their eyes and sit there and say, look, there is a better way to go about doing things. And so the reason I don't like traditional styles of annuities is you give your money to the insurance company. It effectively becomes their property and they give you an allowance off of your own money. So you lose the utility of your capital, right? The type that we use as a bond substitute, not a stock substitute, as a bond substitute, it's just an accumulation vehicle. When you die, it passes to your heirs just like an IRA would. Profits and gains. The best way to think about these products is like a balanced mutual fund, but it has no management fees and it's insured against loss. And guys, if someone's telling you something different, they don't know what they're talking about. I don't think they're lying. I don't think they're a charlatan. I'm not going to sit there and try to tell them. Well, they're a little bit of a charlatan because they're pretending that they know and they don't. And that's why it's so great to get Roger Ibbotson on, is because I don't care who your guy is. You know, sit there and tell him, well, my guy says this and you say that, Zach. Well, if you're comfortable, if you think that your guy or that Dave Ramsey, God bless him, I think he's a great guy. I think he's done. I love 98% of what he says. If you're a Ken, if you're a Fisher investment guy, you know, even Ken Fisher, big name, right? Well, he's in solid disagreement with Roger Ibbotson. And if you look at the body of work, you look at the background, you look at the career. If you want to go with Ken Fisher as opposed to Roger Ibbotson, great. Be my guest. Don't think it's worked out well if you've done that in the past. But I just think it's about, like I said, I know there's a lot of people out there like that. Just, you know, hey, Zach, you know, the reason why I haven't called you or, you know, whatever. I like the radio show, like the podcast, but I just, you know, we don't do annuities. Okay, fine. But the vast majority, and look, for some of you, it's not appropriate. I'm not saying it is for everybody else. And I'm not saying it's appropriate for everybody, but. If you are approaching retirement or you're in retirement, I haven't met many people that they can't help. Who does not want to pay less fees, make more money, and have less risk? And if you say me, then God help you, because that is investing. That's all it's about. It's about risk management. It's about how do we take less risk and make more money? I mean, that's it. And I think there's a sea change going on. I think the financial industry is starting to wake up to this. Much, you know, a lot of that thanks goes to Roger Ibbotson because he's opening people's eyes that these aren't your grandma's, you know, these aren't your parents' or your grandparents' annuities. This is a completely different ballgame. It shouldn't even really be called an annuity because it has no annuitizing aspect of it. It's not a guaranteed income vehicle. It's just a growth vehicle. That's it. It's got no cap to the upside. So we've made double-digit returns. Anyway, we've talked a lot about it, but I just think that if you're one of those people that's been skeptical of what we say, then you got to hear this interview. And not just because he agrees with us, just because he's a wealth of knowledge. The guy, like I said, I was by far the most nervous to do this interview of any interviews I've ever done, just because I still can't believe I've met Dr. Ibbotson before about a year and a half ago in New York, but you know, it was kind of a meet and greet type thing. And I didn't get a chance to talk to him. The fact that I got to sit down and talk to it for an hour with Roger Ibbotson is just still kind of blows my mind. It's one of the only interviews I've actually listened to just cause I was trying to let it sink in, and we got done with the interview and I couldn't even really remember what I'd asked. You know, it was kind of a blur moment just cause this is a guy, you know, I'm going back to business school days, reading studies that the guy's done, reading his published work, reading books. You know, it's just what a blessing to be able to interview somebody like that. And like I said, whoever is giving you a bad steer about those fixed index products we're talking about as a bond replacement. You know, there is no more educated voice on this than Roger Ibbotson. So if you are comfortable taking your financial advisor's advice over Roger Ibbotson, be my guest. But if you have listened to me talk about it and you doubt it and it makes you doubt what we do and doubt, then listen up to this interview. And I think it's really going to change your mind, because it should change your mind, because we're right. We're right. We just are. The performance over the last 7-8 years shows it. You know, the performance will show it when the next crash comes, which, you know, it will. I think we're getting closer to it by the day. But anyway, great interview coming up, and I just encourage you all to listen to it. Again, we got to follow that format because we want to do a market update. I was planning on just rolling the interview totally so you guys could hear it all on radio, but obviously there's a lot that's gone on, and we want to do a quick market update, and then we'll get to the radio, then we'll get to the interview, and we're going to probably cut off the last 15 to 20 minutes of that interview. So if you want to hear the remainder of it again, which I encourage you to do, this is he doesn't do a lot of interviews, doesn't do a lot of public appearances. So this is a rare treat, not just for me, but for everybody. And if you don't know who he is, just go Google him. You know, the guy is a monster in the world of finance. So just so pumped to bring this to you guys. And, you know, lost track there. I get too excited just introducing it. Anyway, so when we cut off, we're going to cut it off early. You can go to our podcast page on iTunes, which you can find a link on our website at bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. You can also just Google Know Your Risk Radio and Stitcher. Stitcher is a podcast page that we're on that's very easy to, you know, very easy to navigate, very, very, you know, user-friendly. It's got all of the episodes we've ever done. But it just, again, if you've sat there and doubted me, or if you've thought it sounded attractive and just, you know, you weren't really enticed to call or whatever that is, then you got to hear this interview. You got to hear it, because most of you are going to end up with one of these products. The sad part about it is you're going to do it when the pain gets too great, right? When you're sitting on 5, 6, 7 years of ridiculously low returns in your bond portfolio, you probably already are. And your advisor will capitulate. We're seeing it happen every single day, right? And God forbid rates go up, right? Because then the bond losses are really going to get serious. So, and then the other side of it too is the other big utility, guys, in the most expensive stock market in U.S. history, the other advantage is it lets you dial back your equity risk. And hey, we've had a heck of a run this week, right? Everybody's really excited. Just remember, this run we've had this week is all based on weaker economic data. Okay, so we've been telling you for years, markets are not telling the story that they used to tell. So anyway, this is a perfect jump off opportunity to get into the market update. But like I said, stay tuned. We got the interview with Dr. Ibbotson coming up. I think it's invaluable, and I really hope you guys enjoy it. I'm pumped to get it out there, and I still feel lucky. The other cool thing is he admitted, Darren, did you hear that? He said, now it's a pleasantry in radio, I get that, but he said he'd like to come back on. Did you hear that? I'm going to hold him to it. Sit there and go, hey, you said, I'm going to be like a little kid, right? Daddy, you said. Anyway, so a fascinating interview, fascinating guy, and what a get. Just still blows my mind. Anyway, market update. Wow. Again, we don't want to overreact. We're still below the all-time highs that were set in September. We're bumping right around. You know, we haven't broke out of the range yet. But what is fascinating to me is that, again, not recessionary. Everybody's still preaching the lingo that the economy is blowing and going and everything's great and blah, blah, blah. Again, comparatively speaking to the rest of the world, things still look good. But virtually every economic indicator that we are looking at is trending the wrong way. Again, there aren't red lights flashing at all, but it just looks like things are slowing. There are red lights flashing in many places around the world. Again, that shouldn't be an alarm sign. We've seen that a few times, throughout the last really 9 years, and they all prove to be scares. And so that could be this. The reason that we are concerned, and we've been concerned for 2 years, like I said, people are like, oh, you've been concerned so long. Let me remind you again that we've been concerned for 2 years and the market's gone nowhere for 20 months. So, or 19, right in there. Anyway, so yeah, I don't really think it's been wrong to be concerned. But what's going on this week is we just got a much weaker than expected jobs number. Again, not an alarm bell. These jobs numbers can be noisy, but it matches up with a sharp decline we've seen in things like heavy truck orders. Last month, heavy trucks, so big trucks, think, you know, like Kenworth, Peterbilt, you know, stuff like that. Heavy truck orders were down something like 70%. And again, that could be 1 month of noise. You can't look at any one of these data points and make too much about it, right? It's a big mistake, a mistake I've made in the past. We continue to see what really looks like a recession in manufacturing. And I say recession, not a collapse, just a contraction. And so all of these things are really, you know, there's a lot of data points that point to slowing. Now, maybe that just means we pull back to 1.5% annualized growth like we had in the Obama years. Doesn't mean that it necessarily has to signal, you know, an apocalypse of asset prices or anything like that. But it's things that we want to be conscious of. And one of the biggest reasons for it is we are now pushing off or 3.5% or something like that off all-time highs, 3% off all-time highs. Remember, record valuations across the board. The thing that's different with this is we are looking like we've got blow-off tops all over the place except in big stocks. So the FANG leaders, you know, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Netflix, things like that, they're still well off their highs. What's pulling this market up the most is the highest priced junk is going through the roof. I'm talking up 22%, 15%, 8% today alone. Zoom Technologies is one of them. It's up 22% or something like that. If you own Zoom Technologies, you might think it's the greatest thing in the world. You hold that stock for a number, you know, you hold that stock for another year or two and you're going to get crushed. The valuation is laughable. It is trading at something like 60 to 70 times sales. And its competition is Skype, which is owned by Microsoft. I mean, it's maybe they look as a company, they could end up doing great. Just the valuation is just insane. Beyond Meat, that new vegan patty that went out, it's up pushing an $8-9 billion market cap with $140 million of revenue. It's just a joke. This is looking very, very reminiscent of 99. And people are like, oh, Zach, you've been saying that. Just pull up the charts, guys. Just go pull up the charts. We were crazy before. This is nuts. This is nuts. On a mathematical basis, you can't make sense of it. It's just nuts. Walmart with a 45 price to earnings ratio on it. Walmart, now they're a tech company. The valuation side of this just continues to get crazier. And everybody keeps talking about the PE ratio, which is the most noisy valuation metric. And they won't even bring up the other nine valuation metrics that say that we're in the 96th, 97th, 98th percentile in history, if not at all-time record highs, with the economy slowing. And everything about this rally is all about, literally, this rally is happening because of bad economic news, because the market is saying that the Fed's going to have to cut rates, which I think they're going to. Right? But 10 years into the longest, this is not good news. This is a perfect setup. And again, I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, but this is what happens right before recessions start and things get nasty. So there could not be a better, and I've been saying it, we've been in this sideways pattern now for 2 years. I actually think the odds on our favorite that we go a higher from here. I think we've kind of started a blow off top of sorts here in the marketplace. And who knows how much higher it could go. But if you're trying to time this and you think you'll get out in time, best of luck to you. Okay, best of luck to you. The best thing you could do is take some of this, you know, some of these highest, you know, these stocks trading at their highest valuation of all time, reduce your risk and move it into something like our bond replacement strategy that rises with the market but is insured against loss if the market goes down. Now is the time. And I've been saying it. And look, I'm fully aware. I'm a student of financial history. I am fully aware. I hear it.
oh, Zach, you're a worry wart. You're negative outlook. And the sky is falling.
Look, financial history is littered with this. Typically, when you start ringing the alarm bell, on average, you're usually somewhere between 15 to 25% away from the highs of the market, and you're going to be called an idiot for 2 or 3 years. It's the way it worked. We started getting worried about housing at the end of 2005. I felt like an idiot for almost 2 years. But boy, we didn't when everything fell apart. So anyway, guys, just go look at it yourself. Look at the value. This is just, we are in la la land. This is just getting rich. And I'm not really disgusted. I'm good with it. For me, it's entertaining. I'm seeing things I never thought I'd see. Not again. I just never thought you'd see valuations this nuts where investors are just chasing stock prices. They're not even paying attention to the underlying fundamentals. The other thing, they're not paying attention to debt loads. Just saw a data point out this week. And Darren's telling me I got to go. And I'm going to wrap it up because we got to get to the Ibbotson interview. But data point I saw this week, for the first time ever in the history of the United States financial system, junk debt now makes up a larger percentage of the corporate bond market than investment grade. And that is the first time it's ever happened. The historical average is somewhere between 60 to 70% investment grade and somewhere between 30 to 40% junk. Junk is now at like 51 or 52%, investment grade's at like 48 or 49. We are drowning in debt. And last year, 44% of bond issuers, so the number of all people issuing bonds, companies issuing bonds, 44% of them were rated B3, or the lowest credit rating you can get. Junk debt. 44% of issuers were issuing junk debt. To give you a reference, in 2007, at the peak of that cycle, that number was 22%. So we literally have double the amount of issuers issuing junk debt than we did in 2007. Once again, these data points on their own do not point to a clear conclusion. Nobody, including me, has a crystal ball. What I am telling you is we are checking off every stinking box available to say that a market is maxed. And like I said, my suspicion is we'll go higher from here. But if you are trying to tap dance the line, you think you're going to be smart enough and have good enough timing to get out, best of luck. It's the lie everybody tells themselves. Now is the time to de-risk, take advantage of record valuations, record prices, and slow your risk down. And that's where the bond replacement strategy comes in, because if I'm wrong, great, you're going to go keep going up with the market. It's going to be phenomenal. You're going to crush the performance of the bonds you have in your portfolio. You're going to drastically lower your fees because they've got no management fee and they're insured against loss. But now's the time, guys. Now's the time. At least get a second opinion. At least look into it. And if you want to do that, give us a call. 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. You can go to you can go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. You can read the Roger Ibbotson white paper. You can listen to the interview that we got coming up. And if you don't want to talk to us directly, because that seems a little bit too forward, you can email us. We can do it back and forth over email, but you just need to look into this. Now is the time. And I like, you've been saying that for 2 years. Yeah. Well, guys, the market hasn't gone anywhere. So now is the time. Now is the time. Do not sit there and get caught flat-footed like you have two times in the last two decades. Because this is just nuts. It's nuts. And like I said, if it keeps going up, great. We're going up with it. But if it doesn't, you got a chair when the music stops. And you know what? And if you disagree with me, look, I honestly hope you're right. This isn't something I want to come true. Right? The more the accounts go up, more market, more money I make. Great. More money the clients make. I love it. But what our job as a fiduciary is to manage risk and make sure you're fine no matter what happens. Okay, and your modern portfolio ain't cutting it. It's not. It didn't cut it. I mean, you've seen the results. Look at the last 20 years of performance. You've underperformed by about 50%. Nobody thinks about that now. because nobody cares about stuff like that at all-time highs. Hey, it's good, Zach. You know better. You know better. Get a second opinion. Listen to Roger Ibbotson. You don't believe me? You should believe him. Listen to Ibbotson and de-risk, guys. Manage your risk. Think long-term. Don't chase markets. Where do you want to be in 5 and 10 years? Don't think about where you want to be by August. Okay? That'll get you killed. Anyway, without further ado, I've gone over. Big surprise. But anyway, guys, hey, we're going to tee it up. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK. We can help you out. We can walk you through the products that Ibbotson and I talk about in the interview, talk about the role that they could play in your portfolio. We don't have a tricky sales process. We just present what we got, show you the cost, show you the performance, and let you make the decision, and you call us if you like it. It's that simple. So anyway, give us a call, but enjoy the interview. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Many people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than it would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay your estate back with interest if you never use it. But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your children have to do is carry out your wishes, and you're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice my wife and I got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian's asset-based class is Friday, June 21st in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering self-funding their long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that is not the best idea. Seating will be limited for this special asset-based class, June 21st in Bellevue. Reserve your spot right now, 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com. One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high cost of an extended healthcare situation. A lot of people assume they have enough money saved only to watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Don't make this mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you won't become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn all about the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay your estate back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott, who's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. There are classes coming up this month, Saturday the 15th and Friday the 21st. Seating's limited, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. Classes are free. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys so much for joining us. And we have a very, very special guest with us today, somebody that I've been looking forward to interviewing for a really long time. Never honestly thought I'd get the chance to. This is a gentleman who's had an impact on the way that we manage money. Somebody that we've followed for a long time, a giant in the industry. I'm sure he wouldn't refer to himself as that, but I will do that for him. But anyway, without further ado, Mr. Roger Ibbotson, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, it's great to be here.
Okay, so I'm going to go down. Now, there's certain topics that we really want to cover because, as I've said, you've had an impact in the way that we manage our clients' money, the way that we run our business. But I have to start with the beginning of your career, just because I think it's fascinating, the people that you've worked with, the work that you've done. Tell us a little bit about your beginnings, the incredible people that you've had the opportunity to work with. Kind of give us the story about how you started and how you got where you are.
I guess I really, what really propelled me in this field was getting my PhD at the University of Chicago. Before that, I actually wasn't exactly planning on getting a PhD after I got my MBA, but I had a few jobs that really didn't work out, and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so I went back to school to get a PhD. And, of course, at the University of Chicago at that time, I have to say, this is a while back. I graduated in the 70s. But at the University of Chicago at that time, it was really the center of so many things that were happening because, for example, the Black-Scholes model, options model came out, and Fisher Black and Myron Scholes were on my committee. The idea of efficient capital markets came out, and Eugene Fama was the chairman of my committee. And, of course, we had the Miller Modigliani perspective on corporate finance, which totally changed the way you look at corporate finance. And Merton Miller was on my committee, so I had a wonderful group of people to work with, and I actually ended up staying on the faculty at the University of Chicago as well. Before I came to Yale in 1984, actually, so I've been at Yale now for 35 years, but. Taking us back a second, actually the first real job that I had of a success was while I was a PhD. While I was a PhD student, I actually was asked to be a consultant to the investment office of the university's endowment. And one of the things they asked me about is, what should we do with this bond portfolio? And I said, well, I can manage that. And so I ended up managing the bond portfolio prior to while I was a PhD student, actually. So I actually got some real hands-on experience as well. And then I ended up on the faculty at Chicago, as they say, for 10 years after that. So it was a great start. But then, of course, Yale's been a great place to be, too.
And you've been a professor of finance now at Yale for how long has that now been? Is it 30 years?
35 years. I mean, of course, it makes me so young, but it's 35 years.
And what's fascinating to me is all the work that you've done and as influential as you've been in the world of finance. And from reading about you and hearing previous interviews, you alluded to this, but you weren't really targeting a career in finance. I believe that you thought you were or the original plan was to join the family business. Is that not correct?
Well, yeah, my father had a Ibbotson Heating Company. Actually, it's still in the family. Actually, it's another couple generations down already running the business. But it's stayed in the family. And I would have probably gone into that business myself if I had more mechanical skills. And I have to admit that I didn't. And my father would have forgiven me for what I didn't know, but still, I wanted to do something I was better at. And actually, finance is the perfect sort of thing because it is practical, but it's sufficiently abstract where you don't really get your hands dirty. It's actually been the perfect kind of career for me.
Well, I sit there and I wonder sometimes. It's certainly a noble practice, great business. You know, I think that the world of the world is better off with you in the world of finance, the field of finance, as opposed to heating and air conditioning and things of that nature. So I think you made a good choice.
I'm not saying you shouldn't heat your houses and air condition your houses. I think those are important things to do too.
Oh, absolutely.
However, for me, I really had to relate to what I was actually good at, which was I've always been good quantitatively, I guess, and good at understanding concepts and so forth. And of course, I can't fix anything. Mechanically, I can't fix anything. I think I can fix financial problems.
That's probably one of the only things that we have in common. I'm right there with you. I've been better on the number side than the engineering side or the practical, you know, fixing things. That's really not my forte. But anyway, wanted to move on. The other thing that's always fascinated me about you and your work, as you mentioned, is the people that you worked with. You were on the ground. I mean, I think about this all the time. I was watching a documentary about long-term capital the other day. I knew the story. I knew that the basis of their model was based off Black-Scholes. And while prepping for the interview, I forgot that you know, those were two of your colleagues, close colleagues that you worked with. Black and Scholes. It just amazes me how many of the things that you've been right smack dab in the middle of. I mean, you know, the listeners of our radio show may not know this, but Black Scholes really transformed the world of finance in many ways, in some ways the world. Did you meet those? How did you guys come together? You said they were on your committee. How did that group of you Chicago boys, how did that come together? What was the genesis of that?
We had a lot of things going on at the University of Chicago. Of course, we had Milton Friedman there at the time, and I took his courses and so forth. But the finance group, I guess, was one of the really hot areas, really with I probably started with Gene Fama really pushing, Gene Fama and Merton Miller really pushing, but actually their students were actually Myron Scholes was one of their students and so forth. So he came into the picture and so forth. So this was a group that just happened to be there, and a lot of the most important discoveries were happening at the University of Chicago. Of course, there were other universities like MIT and so forth, which were also involved. But it was definitely a time of huge discoveries going on in investments. And really changing the whole field, because once you recognize that markets are relatively efficient, the whole way you look at markets is much simpler. Once you see the Black-Scholes models, you understand how arbitrage works and how options and so forth can be priced. So we're really getting a theoretical grounding on how the markets worked. I also, as I say, I was a bond portfolio manager, so I could see a lot of those concepts, which had been developed earlier, but were really first getting applied, like duration and term structures of interest rates and so forth. So it was really a wonderful place to start. I got to say, though, that Yale's also been a wonderful place to be at, because I've been a professor at Yale since 1984, and Yale has really developed on the behavioral finance side. And so, you know, I have a new monograph, a new book called Popularity, A Bridge Between Classical and Behavioral Finance. So classical finance is things like rationality and efficient markets, and behavioral finance allows for emotions and irrationality. And once you can put all that together, you really see the whole perspective on capital markets.
And I'm glad you brought that up. One more jot down on my list was talk to you about this new book based on popularity. I've read a lot of your work on this, and I think it's fascinating. But before I get to that, one of the things that's interested me so much about your career and your life is, and I don't know how many people know this, but you are not just a professor of finance. You also run a finance, you run a hedge fund, a fund, Zebra Capital, and you are intimately involved in other, you know, financial matters. The work that you're doing on the annuity side of things, you've got your hands in a lot of things, and then you're also in the world of academia. There's not a lot of guys that straddle those lines. What was the first love? Was it the finance side, or was it the instruction, or did you see, or teaching, being a professor, or did you see those two things marrying up? Did you see them kind of as an extension of the other? What was the first love, and do you think that one helps you be better at the other? How does that union work? It's not very common.
Well, it's always been a synergistic for me. These things work together. So I was, of course, first interested in finance and economics, but I always leaned toward the practical side. So a lot of it seemed like deep theory, and I always was looking for ways to apply this. And, of course, one of the ways to apply this is in, I started out as consulting, and then I, and one of the things we can talk about shortly is stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation, all the data sets that I built. But after building those data sets, there was so much interest in this that people were asking me to be a consultant all over the place. And so I started a consulting business, Ibbots and Associates, which I eventually, years later, sold to Morningstar.
Yeah.
In 2006, but it was a data and software business, a financial data and software business. And so, and it's only after that that I really focused on Zebra Capital, where we were building hedge funds, equity management, and of course various indexes that are used in annuity products. But I guess the overall theme here is everything all the research that I've done, and I've done, of course, a lot of research over the years, research, teaching, running businesses, they're all very interconnected, and they all feed on each other. So I don't actually necessarily think of them as so distinct activities. I think of them as you might say I've got a lot of work to do. The fact that I've got teaching and research and running businesses, it seems like I'm really an overly busy person or something like that. But that's not quite true. It's because so many of the things that you do in one field actually applies to the other field. And so you're always like double dipping at everything you do, I guess.
Yeah, well, if you're one of those guys that can proficiently operate in both fields, which is not the most common thing. Now, on your work on popularity, it's probably a topic that the vast majority of our listeners have not heard discussed as it relates to finances and investing. And I have found it to be endlessly fascinating because I feel like for me, it put words and research to things that I had thought about, but in very non-direct, non-accurate or non-defined ways. And then reading your work, it was kind of like the light went on. You know, it kind of reminded me of physics. You know, you observe these things your whole life, and then you go start going through physics classes, and you go, oh, that's why that works that way. Oh, that makes sense. It was kind of a light bulb going on moment for me. Can you, and before I botch it, because I am nowhere, not even close to an expert on this, but can you give our listeners a summation of some of the work that you've done, as well as your new book on popularity? Like I said, I find it endlessly fascinating, and I would love to know. I feel like that work, from my perspective, is especially important today when understanding asset prices and some of the, and it's always been to a degree. But do you agree with me? Do you think that it's especially prescient right now? Or do you think it's no more prescient than it's been? So that's a lot of questions I'm throwing at you. But yeah, just go over that work and then kind of tell me where you think it fits in today.
Okay, first of all, let me say on this, it's a CFA Institute monograph that you can load for free if you go down to your site. I think you can buy it for about $10 or something like that, a hard copy, and you can also get it on Amazon for maybe a little more than that. So it's easily accessible, and I think it's actually very simple. We, in many ways, we've made investments into some complicated field here. We talk about all the different premiums you have, risk premiums, and different all these different payoffs for different factors and so forth. What we're saying is that for any of these factors or premiums to be relevant, they have to be something that is actually unpopular. In other words, anything that is any kind of security that is really popular for whatever reason, say relative to their cash flows, if investors really like it relative to their cash flows, their expected cash flows, that means they're going to raise the price, raise the valuation. But if they raise the valuation, it means they're going to have lower expected returns in the future. And so the kind of things that actually have payoffs, that you actually have the really good returns, are the things that people don't like for some reason. It may be just that they never heard of it, or they're unfamiliar with it, or something like that. Or it might be something that's I guess in classical economics, the key thing is if it was risky. We always knew that, and I've studied it, that risky securities people don't like, and therefore they have lower valuations, but higher expected returns. The higher the risk, the higher the expected return. Mm. But we're generalizing this, so no longer is it just risk. There are a lot of things we don't like. So, for example, or we like or we don't like. We don't like things that are less liquid. If they're less liquid, they're going to have lower valuations. And, of course, that means they will have higher returns, higher expected returns. You can see that directly in the bond market. You can look at two bonds which are identical in all respects, but one is more liquid than the other. The one that is less liquid will have a higher yield, and there will be a yield spread that will pay off for the reduction in liquidity. So that's just classical economics, classical finance, things like risk and liquidity and how things are taxed and so forth. Those are things that we can like or don't like. And popularity is just how much we like something relative to its actual underlying cash flows. And But once you bring in behavioral finance, you can get mispricing in there. So we can like things just because we like the brand or something like that, or we really know about it, and we might not like something just because we never heard of it, and we get behavioral impacts here. So popularity encompasses both the behavioral and the classical. That means it encompasses both rational thinking and irrational thinking, and it encompasses so many things beyond risk that you originally think about as the sort of the classical first thing you think about. Yes, we don't like risk. Yes, risk is unpopular. Yes, risk deserves a higher expected return. But it's not alone. There are a lot of other things we don't like that will also give us a higher expected return. So that's what this book is all about, and gives lots of examples, and it gives some empirical tests of this to demonstrate it and so forth, and it's just common sense.
Yeah.
But bringing back financial theory to things that are common sense that all of us can understand, all my life I've tried to apply things, but applying things generally means take some complicated theory and turn it into something that all of us can relate to.
Yeah, it reminds me, and we talk about this on the show all the time, reminds me of the old adage that if you really understand something, you should be able to explain it simply in a couple sentences, right? And I find, and that's what's so intriguing to me about this work, and you, like I said, you may or may not agree. I think it's especially prescient right now, especially considering this record divergence between value and growth. I feel like this is a really prescient time for this to be coming out. And I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you I'd been scratching my head at some of the valuations that some of these popular things are getting versus some of these other businesses that I think look attractive that aren't popular and they just seem to be getting taken to the woodshed. Do you see that as well, or do you think that maybe I'm looking at a couple instances and being unfairly biased at the market? Do you think that that's a big part of what's going on today? And if not, where am I wrong?
Well, it's a little bit unusual today because long term, if you look at it, the value companies have the higher returns than the growth companies.
Yeah.
The growth companies are the great companies with the great stories, and they intend to be overvalued, and they may be overvalued today. And the value companies are the companies that have some strong fundamentals, but really are not great companies, but turn out to be, because of their valuations, great stocks.
Yeah.
But what's happened recently, of course, is the growth companies have done much better than the value companies. Long-term value companies have actually done better than growth companies, but more recently, growth companies have done much better than value companies. It's a question of, so maybe value companies got to be too popular after all the literature, the financial literature saying you should buy value and not growth. But certainly now I guess we're probably getting to the point where value is more destined to have some sort of a turnaround here, because growth has been has had the much higher returns over the last, really, since the crisis in 2008.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So one other thing that came up, and I love your work on liquidity too, because I feel like it's again kind of another thing that I've focused on before, and I think it's, you know, it's, again, it's one of those things that once you hear it, you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, if I've got no impediments or no, you know, nothing blocking me from liquidating this asset and converting it to cash or whatever at any given time, naturally it should hold up you know, a higher premium, a higher valuation, which is, you know, historically why we've seen publicly traded companies with, you know, higher valuations on a relative basis to private companies. And yet that has another thing that is switched. I think we're, well, I don't think, I know, we're seeing these incredible valuations in these private companies. And private equity is, you know, grown to heights that I think at least I didn't imagine it growing to. And I think it's one of the first, at least first time in my career, that I've seen these huge private, you know, these private equity type companies, these private firms going public and getting revalued much lower. What do you attribute that to? Again, do you think I'm nitpicking data, or am I cherry picking and looking at a few situations? Do you notice that as well, this unusual higher valuations in private markets as opposed to public? And what do you attribute that to?
Well, they do. Anything that gets popular gets more popular. I guess the real change in valuations is when things get more popular. Of course, if you're unpopular, you're going to have a relatively low valuation. The ideal security to buy is a security that's unpopular but gets more popular. And what's happened in private equity is, I guess, now it's gotten very popular, so that, yes, even when they go public, they don't go up in value. So that would suggest, of course, that private equity is too popular and might not have good returns going forward if you buy it when it's too popular. It's really your return comes from two sources here. If you getting a low valuation is one source, because you essentially have a high cost of capital or high expected return. But the more immediate effect is a change in popularity. If anything gets more popular, it's going to go up in value, and anything gets less popular, it's going to go down in value. And so we see these changes in popularity, which can certainly dominate returns over the short run. But over the long run, it's ultimately the less popular securities that have the highest returns and the most popular securities that have the lowest returns. In fact, the most popular securities are more likely to get less popular. I mean, if it's already very popular, it's hard to get more popular. You're more likely to get less popular. And the ones that are likely to increase in popularity are the ones that aren't that popular to begin with. Because if you have a great company with a high growth rate, it's very hard to get better, I guess. It's hard to even sustain what you're doing.
Yeah, law of large numbers.
So you often fall from being, you start out at the top, but you can easily fall from that.
You go from the penthouse to the outhouse and a lot quicker than most people think, right?
Well, I'm not going to talk about bathroom talk here. But
Well, that's because you're more of a gentleman than I am. Now skipping ahead to something that I have been looking forward to speaking to you about since 2016. And again, you don't know this, but you had some research, a white paper that you put out in 2016 that was... To put it lightly, it was very encouraging to us. It was very affirming to us. It's a controversial subject in finance, and I to this day am bewildered as to why. And this is kind of a long question. I'll set it up. In 2011-ish, we started looking for alternatives to bonds for our clients. And there were several different factors that we were looking at, but the reasons that we started looking outside of the traditional stock bond allocation had a lot to do with, you know, just interest rates, really. You know, interest rates hit zero. You start looking at bonds and you sit there and go, wait a second, you're asking me to pay a higher price for this security than I have ever paid. And you're expecting me to be happy with the lowest yield that I've ever received. It seemed like there was a lot of negative convexity. And also, as you know, a lot better than I do, the traditional portfolios that are in the RIA worlds and in the asset management worlds, we concentrate further and further into fixed income as the client ages to protect them against volatility. And, you know, we do that because of these relationships between stocks and bonds that we're told stocks, when stocks go down, it's a law that bonds go up. We started looking into that and saying, well, first of all, we don't think that that's a law that's nearly as concrete as it's presented as being. We also think that the projections that we're giving our clients, if we remain in these typical allocations to bonds, we don't see how they're possibly going to get the type of returns that they're looking for. And being a guy that majored in finance and economics and, you know, that spent my life in the financial industry, I always looked down my nose at insurance products. We were taught to believe that insurance products were unsophisticated and expensive and you know, kind of a trick, you know, something that the insurance, you know, a way to cheat clients, if you will, or maybe that's too strong of a word. But, you know, and I don't need to tell you, I'm sure you're aware of this. But throughout our research, looking for something to supplement our bond portfolios with, we stumbled on fixed indexed annuities. Now, we stumbled on, or we were attracted initially to a very specific kind, a kind that had little to no fees, which is possible. You hear all these people railing on annuities and they talk about expenses. And I immediately go, well, you know, unfortunately, you don't know what you're talking about. Looking at more these annuities that are built toward accumulation, that have safety of principle, that grow. And we started using that as a bond supplement and in some cases a bond replacement. And look, the last 6-7 years have been good for equity returns, but the biggest source of outperformance for our clients has come from these products, and they've been remarkable. Again, you know, not to compete against equities, not as an equity replacement, but as a bond supplement or a bond replacement. And we took a lot of flack for that. We were called out, we were questioned, we were doubted, we were seen as being less sophisticated. And when your research paper came out about this, or came out in 2016, it was extremely vindicating. So first of all, thank you. Second of all, give me your take on it. And you know, we're using it as a bond replacement, as a bond supplement. Do you think that's an appropriate role? And what about this? You know, do you feel that swimming upstream in this industry as it relates to these products and this reticence for people to accept them? And if so, what do you attribute that to?
Well, you asked a lot of questions here, but I'll start out with the bond part of this. Of course, bonds have actually been a great place to be over the last really 35 years.
Yeah.
Because they started out in 1981, you know, they were like 14%, even government bonds, you know. And a bond return, you get the yield plus either a capital gain or loss. And if the yields drop, you get a capital gain. And if the yields fall, you get a capital loss. But if you bought bonds in the 1980s at these double-digit rates, you got not only that double-digit yield, but then you got a big capital gain because the rates are falling.
Phenomenal. And so I got to offer my apologies for having to cut this off short, but like I warned in the market update, we ran out of time. But I want you to hear the remainder of this interview because this is one of the biggest living legends of finance. And you can listen to the remainder of the interview by going to our website, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com, and going to our iTunes store. I think the easiest way to pull it up is going to the Stitcher site. So just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher and it'll pull it right up. I think you can also Google Bulwark and Stitcher. But anyway, it's on Stitcher, which is a podcast page. And pull up the rest of this interview and listen to what Dr. Ibbotson has to say. It's such a treat. For those of you that don't know him, he's a monster in the world of finance and has been for the last 40 plus years. Professor at Yale, runs his own management company. Anyway, probably one of the most important interviews we've ever had on the show. So I'd encourage you to go listen to the remainder of that interview. And of course, enjoy the rest of your weekend. And we will talk to you next week. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.